Audible on the Lifetime Podcast.
Okay. Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting Podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find several speaker feeds with over 800 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep the special service active. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle Podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, David G.
Thank you. Hi, I'm David. I'm a compulsive overeater, bulimic. Lisanne, Wera, thank you for asking me. I almost canceled on Lisanne on Thursday, and I'm going through a lot of personal stuff. And I called my sponsor, and I said, you know, Light a Candle is coming up on Saturday. Can I cancel? I'm so fragile. And he said, you're not fragile, you're raw, and you have to speak. And, you know, next month I'll have 13 years of abstinence, and I've been in the rooms for 15 years, and I still need sponsor direction, like one of the birthday people spoke about. Like, I still need good orderly direction to guide me into spiritual principles and a spiritual way of life, because left to my own devices, I'll just want to cancel, I want to draw the blinds, and I don't think I have anything to offer when I'm going through something, and I want to shut down instead of stay open. And, you know, this program teaches me that pain is always the touchstone of spiritual growth. And one of the daily readers, it's my favorite daily readers, and, you know, one of the quotes, it says, the years will show what the days never could. And for me, when I'm in something, I think I'm never going to get out of it. And then when I look back, when I have 13 years and I look back at my story, I'm like, oh, my God, there was a power that was higher and greater than myself guiding me every single step, every single breakup, every single job that I didn't get, every single, you know, right turn that went left. There was God in all of that. And sometimes it just takes time for me to be in the hallway and then look back. But, you know, what it was like for me, I grew up on Long Island. My dad is a prominent doctor, and my mom is an early childhood trauma psychologist. So on the outside, we kind of had it all together. But on the inside, it was complete war in my house. My dad was a rager. My mom has been in and out of these rooms and suffers from mental illness and has been in psych wards and out of psych wards and thought she was a mobster and thought she was, you know, she's turned into all of these different things. But for me, growing up in alcoholism and growing up in abuse and growing up in severe mental illness, it just made me always feel like I'm not safe and like there's just no ground beneath my feet. And it was very chaotic in the first 7 years. And I remember once my dad was raging through the house and I was 7 years old and my mom and I locked ourselves in her meditation room. And I said, we have to go. And she said, I know. And I said, we have to go tonight. And we packed up all our stuff and moved across Long Island. And within a week, we were living in a new house. And my mom had a new man in the house. And there was a hardcore child custody battle with my dad. And for a couple of years, my dad's abuse was getting worse, but the court hadn't taken away custody. And I used to beg my mom to not let me go with my dad on weekends. And she would be like, he's not abusive. That never happened. And I remember just feeling like I know my reality, but this person who I'm supposed to trust is not validating it. And it's still my biggest wound today, you know, with 13 years and I'm 36 years old. That idea of like, I know what the truth is, but this person's telling me I'm crazy. That's something that I've had to deal with my whole life. But court ended up taking away custody, and I didn't talk to my dad for about 15 years and had this manic single mother who, you know, would move to India or would marry this guy or turn into this guy, you know, turn into a Hasidic rabbi's wife. Like, she was always drastically changing her personality, and I always felt like, where am I? Who am I? What am I? Just nothing ever felt grounded. And I found the food at a really young age. And I remember those early moments when I was 7 or 8, just having the food just felt so grounding for me and so safe. And like, I would come home from school And I was scared that my dad was going to, like, come and take me and my sister. And my mom, you never knew who she was. So the food was just always constant. And it was always there, and it was always safe. And I had so much anxiety. And the food just kind of dulled it, and it made it go away. And I would just eat over it and eat over it. And then within a couple years, I was 60 pounds overweight, and I was fat. And I started getting picked on in school. And it was almost like I stuffed the problem of the childhood trauma into the basement. And the problem just started becoming about the food. And I was getting picked on every day, and I was bullied. And I just kept eating over it. And I kept stuffing my face in sugar and flour and ice cream. And I would come home after a full day of getting bullied, and then I would eat over the shame that I was getting bullied, and then I would just get fatter and fatter and fatter, and I was just in this lull. Like, they say we cross this invisible line, and I came into OA when I was 21, and people used to say, "You're so lucky, you're so young, you have your whole life ahead of you," and I hated hearing that, and I'm sure a lot of young people who come in have that experience of, like, we don't want to be told we're lucky. If we're here, it means we crossed the invisible line at such a young age. So that's a lot of pain to have gone through as a kid or as a teenager in the early 20s. To be here, to really earn our seat and to stay here, like, you have to have been through a lot of pain. And, you know, I'm 60 pounds overweight, and I just hate my life, and I'm suicidal. And what happened was I found bulimia, and I found diet pills. And I was a junior in high school, and I transferred high school. So I was this big, fat kid. And then in the summer going into my junior year, I lost about 60 pounds. I started taking 15 pills of hydroxycut every day, and I started taking laxatives, and I started starving and purging and just exploring the dark side of bulimia. And by the time I transferred into this new school, I looked skinny, and I started getting attention from girls, and I was like, what is this? I still felt fat, but I was getting, like, the prettiest girl in school wanted to hang out with me, and nothing ever happened. But in my mind, I switched to, like, I have to go to any lengths to make sure that this keeps happening. And I turned into a raging bulimic. And, you know, I was a three-sport athlete my junior and senior year, and I used to pass out during sports practice. And I would wake up early and go to the gym and then starve all day on diet pills and then go to sports practice at night and then, like, stuff my face with peanut butter. And that's kind of what high school was like. And then college was worse. So college, I went to 5 colleges in 4 years, and I just was in the food the whole time. I don't remember friendships or partnerships or dating or fraternity life or classes. I just remember the gym and where the bathrooms were in the towns that I went to college, where I could purge, and how many thousands of calories I binged, and how I went to any lengths to get rid of it. And I once had a college roommate, like, the sweetest guy from, like, middle America, and his grandma, before she died, left him, like, a chunk of fudge. And he, like, whenever he felt sentimental, he would, like, come home and, like, eat a little square of the fudge. And I didn't know, but one day I went home in a binge and I ate his whole fudge thing. And I, like, replaced it like we did from, like, Ralph's. And he's like, "Where's my grandma's fudge?" And it was humiliating, like, having to lie and be like, "Oh, what are you talking about? I didn't take the fudge." And that was my life. I was a liar. I was a cheat. I was a steal. And I was just always in the food, and I didn't care. Like, nothing was ever going to stop me. And my senior year in college, I ended up in Manhattan, and I started going through psychosis. And I was just on so many hydroxycut pills for so many years, and binging and purging in Cozy. You know, Cozy was a restaurant in New York, and in my experience, they had the best bathrooms that you could purge in. And, like, that was my life. Like, I wasn't thinking about dating. I was thinking about purging. And I was living in Manhattan, and I was starting to hit a bottom in another program, and I had ended up hospitalized because of that. But food was my number one. Like, food and overeating and purging, like, that's my number one program. But that other program really brought me to my knees quicker. And I started going from every single Whole Foods in New York City, like binging. And I would count on my phone in my notes section how many thousands of calories I was binging per Whole Foods. And I knew in my head, like, how many calories were in everything. Like, I knew a dried bag of mangoes. I knew how many thousands of calories that was. I knew peanut butter or almond butter jar. I was a gourmet binger. I didn't even have money. I don't know where the money came from, but I was, like, Whole Foods all the time, every day. Almond butter, like, gluten-free, whatever. Banana bread. But I knew the calories and everything, and then I would go down to my gym in Soho, Crunch Gym, and I wouldn't leave the gym each day until the calories that I binged matched the calories that I exercised at the gym. And I would be at the gym for like 5 hours a day, every day, and then I would go in the sauna to take a break and sweat out more, and then I'd go on the scale, and then I'd go back on the treadmill, and I was I was in pain, and I was just pounding through every day, and I would go back on the subway, back to my apartment in Williamsburg, and I would say, tomorrow would be different. In Williamsburg, there was this bagel shop, like, on the way to the subway in the morning, and I just couldn't, I was like a jaywalker. I would just end up in the bagel shop every morning, and I would say, I'm just going to get, like, a bottle of water, and I would end up, like, trying out, they had like flavored cream cheese, and I would like end up in the cream cheese, and then I'm like 8 Yoo-hoos deep and like 10 bagels deep, and then I'm like, well, I'm not going to class today, I'm going to go to the gym and purge it off. And that was my life, like, forever. I don't remember a life that wasn't in the food or thinking about food or how I was going to get rid of it. And deep down, you know, obviously this is food, stuffing, all this other stuff, but deep down, I knew there was so much other pain. I knew there was this family pain. I knew there was pain around my dad and my mom. There was sexual trauma pain. I knew there was, like, relationship pain because I hadn't even been with a partner at that time. There was just all this pain that I was just silencing with the food and stuffing deeper and deeper into the basement and the basement of my subconscious. And, I ended up hitting my bottom my senior year of college. I said, I'm going to kill myself. And I made a decision. I said, I'm going to go back to my mom's apartment, my mom's house on Long Island. I'm going to have one final binge. And I'm binging my way through my mom's house. And it's November. It's around Thanksgiving. So I'm binging my way through, like, leftover Halloween candy. And I'm doing the thing where you're throwing it in the garbage and then taking it out and putting weird things in the microwave and then putting it on the stove and pouring sugar on it, like doing this mad scientist thing. And I'm binging my way, and I make my way into her pantry. And my mom's a psychologist. And as I'm binging my way through her pantry, like a raccoon, like just get all the food out on the ground. An OA 12 and 12 falls out. Like that book right there, an old one, the OA 12 and 12 falls out. And I was like, 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. Like, what's Overeaters Anonymous? And I always say, this was probably the real first miracle of my life, is not that it fell out, it's that I picked it up. Because everyone knows what it's like to be in a binge. Like, you couldn't stop me. And for whatever reason, I had power to pick it up and open it. And in the preamble, here it says right here, it says, Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who through shared experience, strength, and hope are recovering from compulsive overeating or binging or purging or restricting or anorexia. And that sentence changed my life. I was like, what? Because I thought, like, I was the only person who suffered from this thing. And I thought if there was a higher power, like, this was a weird punishment of past karma that I had. Like, I had all this reasoning, and I didn't know this was a thing. I didn't know it was a disease. I didn't know there were rooms to recover. I didn't know there was hope to get better. I just didn't know. And I went to my sister's apartment in New York City the next day, and I said, I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm a bulimic, I'm suicidal, and I don't know what to do. And she printed out the New York City meeting list, and she said, you have to go to OA. And the next week, I went to an anorexic bulimic meeting on the Upper West Side. That was 15 years ago, and I've been coming ever since. And I was just back in New York for a project. I was living there for the last couple months, and I was going to that meeting. And, you know, the joy, first of all, that meeting was, it felt, the room felt so big. And out of the room, I'm like, this room's tiny. But the people are all still there. And some people are different, like, but we're all the same. But a lot of the old people were still there, and they remember me. And how cool is it to go to some place where I remember having so much pain when I walked in the doors, and now I have so much joy, and I'm a completely different person, and I get to be of service. And it's not about pain, pain, pain. It's about, like, who can I help here, and how can I carry the message here? And the whole reason why I go to OA today is completely different from the reason why I came here, which was to just get out of the pain, and now it's to just help other people out of the pain. Like, what an amazing transformation that we get to have here. So yeah, I started going to those meetings, and I used to hear, keep coming back, you know, in New York they say something different, but keep coming back, basically. Even if you're not abstinent, just keep coming back. Just don't leave before the miracle happens. And then I started hearing, find a sponsor who has what you want and ask him how he or she is achieving it. And I was like, what the hell is a sponsor? And then I started hearing about what a sponsor is. And I was like, oh no, I'm not doing the sponsor thing. Like, and so to rewind, when I was in that childhood trauma as a kid, I didn't talk. Like, I didn't speak. I was called mute boy in school. I literally didn't have, like, I truly did not know how to talk. I didn't know how to speak up. I didn't know, even into college, if I had to give an oral presentation in class, I would drop the class. Like, the fact that I'm up here is a miracle. And really, OA, I've spoken around the country, in small rooms and huge rooms. It's a miracle, because when I came in here, I was completely without a voice. Like, I just did not. And I used to have girlfriends, like, in my early recovery, and they'd be like, you don't have a voice. Like, why don't you just speak up? And I was like, I don't have a voice. I don't know how to access it. So the idea of, like, working with a sponsor and being honest and calling somebody, I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm not calling anybody. People used to call me in my early recovery, and I'm like, what? Why are they leaving me voicemails? Like, what? It, like, this, these people are weird. And I never responded to anybody's voicemails. But I kept hearing, like, find a sponsor who has what you want, ask him how he or she is achieving it. And this is what happened. So I was like, all right, I'm 21 years old. What do I want in a sponsor? You know, I had dreams to be in the entertainment industry. So I want a sponsor who's in the entertainment industry. I had dreams to, like, drive a nice car. So I wanted a sponsor at a BMW. I had dreams to find the one, always. Was always looking for the one. So I wanted a sponsor who was married and happily married. Nothing was about recovery. It was just about, like, what do I want out of life, you know? And I looked all over for that sponsor. And I, by another miracle, so here's what happened. Even before I got abstinent, just because I was going to meetings every day, there's power in the room. There's power in the fellowship. Like, my higher power, when I come to a meeting, and I've been traveling for the last 3 years, wherever I go around the country, I get to a meeting because I get healed in a circle, in the healing space. That's where my power is. So just because I wasn't abstinent, I was still getting healed, and things started happening that were way out of my ordinary, that were way out of, like, anything that I ever could have imagined. I got into grad school. I got into UCLA. Like, I was failing out of college, and, like, somehow God worked this miracle thing, and I got into grad school, and I was like, okay, I'm moving across the country. Like, and I learned, like, get new playgrounds. I never would have got abstinent in New York. And I ended up in L.A., and I was still going to meetings every day, and I was looking for that sponsor who worked in the entertainment industry. And I just kept coming back, and I found the sponsor. And I texted him. I was like, can you do a call one time this week? And I asked him, I was like, will you be my sponsor? And he's like, sorry, I'm full. And I was devastated, and I, like, shared, like, nobody wants to be my sponsor, too fucked up, like, I'm too, like, there's just too much. And I was going to these 8,000 Sunset meetings. They're not there anymore, they're on Zoom, but I would go every Monday through Friday, and there was a room, and everybody kept, like, the same people would come, and I was sharing about my woes finding a sponsor. And at the end of a meeting, it was the day before Thanksgiving, 13 years ago, I think, like day or 2 days before, this woman comes up to me, and she said at the end of the meeting, and she said, "I'll temporarily sponsor you." And I like looked her up and down. I'm, what, 23 at this point? And thank God I didn't like interview her, but my head said no, but my heart said, "Okay, yes, let's do it." And we started working the steps that day, and I've been abstinent ever since. And later I found out she didn't have a car. She didn't have a job. She was a lesbian. Like, she did not have anything on my list. But who am I, you know, the set-aside prayer? Like, God, help me set aside everything that I think I know about everything. And that woman saved my life. She took me through the 12 steps in a year. And looking back now, I'm like, there's a saying, you don't have to dance with everybody, but you have to dance with somebody. And I needed somebody to just tell everything to. And that woman was the perfect person because she, I felt like she could hold everything that I had to reveal when I got to my fourth and my fifth step. And there was a lot. There was a lot of trauma. There was a lot of sex stuff. Like, she was the perfect person, and I just never felt judged. And by the time I got through the 12 steps, I was restored to sanity with food. And there was about, actually, when I had about 6 months, I was asked to lead Kitchen Sink for the first time. And it was a huge meeting, and I was just learning how to, like, share and use my voice and what my story was. And I led Kitchen Sink, and after, like, people were just coming up to me, and it was just too much. Like, it was just too much energy, and I remember I went home and just ate over it. And I called my sponsor, and I said, "I think I have to start over." And she said, "What did you eat?" And I told her everything. And she said, "David, just stay on the train." And that is what's great about a sponsor who... I call my sponsors like numerous times a week. They've been through me through the best, through the worst. They know me inside and out. They know me. Like, they know me. They know me probably better than I know myself. So when I call my sponsor, I'm like, "Do I have to lead this meeting? David, just show up." But that's what's great about a sponsor in this journey is, left to my own devices, I would have started over because I'm a perfectionist. I'm black or white. I'm a bulimic. And I would have just been back at day one, day 20, day 30, back to day one, probably for the rest of my life. But my sponsor had me sit with the uncomfortability of imperfection and just keep gathering momentum. And I think there is a momentum and a confidence that at least I got in my first year by getting the chips and by sharing and saying 60 days, 90 days, 6 months, a year. Like, it was such a big deal for me to just get time and not be perfect. And over the years, you know, the food just doesn't call to me. Like, I don't live in a world where I don't think anything could happen to me at this point, because what's going on in my life is probably the worst thing that I ever could have imagined. I don't think anything would turn me to food or purging. I'm just restored to sanity, and I live a life as a man in recovery that tries to the best of my ability to follow those 12 steps. And in that first year, my sponsor used to take the bus from downtown to Culver City, and I would have my notebook, and, you know, my weekends, I was in grad school, but, like, my whole life started being about recovery and doing the work and doing the writing and going to meetings and getting commitments. And there was a homework aspect to the 12 steps in the beginning. Like, there was a, I want her to know how good I'm doing. Like, I was really writing out thoughtful answers, and that's where I was in the beginning. But now, like, as the years have gone on, it's not about homework. It's not about getting a grade. Like, these 12 steps are, they're spiritual principles that show me how to live my life. And throughout any problem that I'm having, I get to turn to 12 steps and they guide me. I'm powerless over food. For me, I had to get honest. Like, when I put flour or sugar inside my body, I turn into an alcoholic. I turn into, like, a fentanyl addict. Like, I don't know how to describe it. When flour or sugar is in my body, I end up on the 405, I end up at 7-Eleven, Jamba Juice. Like, I'm just all over the place. My life just goes in such a wacko direction. So no matter what, I just don't eat flour or sugar, and I haven't been doing that for 13 years. But my life is unmanageable, and my life's unmanageable drunk or sober, abstinent or not abstinent, deading or not deading, shopping or not shopping, dating or not dating. My life's unmanageable because I have a mind that talks to me and lies to me and tells me things that I want to listen to, and I have to work 12 steps to, like, change my mind every single day. I wake up with a mind that just talks to me. And how much time? I have some time. All right, thank you. There's so much to talk about. I mean, I'll talk about my dad. So I came in here, I thought I was never going to ever talk to my dad ever again. And after that first year with my sponsor, I realized there was importance of getting a male sponsor because I had so much authority issues, and all my friendships were women, and I couldn't hear anything from men. So I got a male sponsor, and we went through the steps again, and I was angry a lot. And he used to say, like, you might want to start looking at your relationship with your dad. And I was like, don't tell me, blah, blah, blah. But then we got to the fourth step, and then I started to have a change of character. And I started to get less blocked, and I got to see life throughout the filter of victimhood that I'd had my whole life. And, you know, my first sponsor used to say, you were abused. You never have to forgive your dad. You never have to see your dad again. But the next time I went through the steps, I had about 4 or 5 years, and it was like, I do have to forgive my dad. Not for my dad, but for me. I hold on to things. I'm a scorekeeper. I keep score. I keep grudges. I never forgive people. I'm off with your head. Never want to talk to you. Like, that was a pattern that I just got to see in all of my relationships, and it started with my dad. And when I got to my eighth step, I started to pray for my dad. And not for my dad, but I prayed for the anger in my heart to get lifted. And I started praying to forgive my dad. And there's a prayer in the big book, like, you know, the sick man's prayer. And I started praying that for my dad because clearly he was sick. And he was abused. And he didn't have any tools. And he was dating a mentally ill person. Like, I got to see things more clearly. Whereas when I got here, it was just like, woe is me. And I had a greater maturity to all of my relationships. And it says in the big book, you know, we have the total inability to form true partnerships. And partnerships started to form in my early recovery. And I have friendships that I still have from early recovery, 10, 12-year relationships today. And when I got here, like, I didn't have any long-term relationships. I wasn't consistent. I wasn't reliable. I wasn't forgiving. I didn't know how to be honest with people. So I started to, like, digest that into my life. And 1 year, I guess, I found myself on a plane because I felt guided, and I saw my dad again, and we went out to lunch, and he said, you know, I'd love to have a relationship with you, and I'm so sorry, and I'd love to try to be a better father. And I slowly let my dad into my life again. And a couple, like, probably years after that, he said, you know, I'd love for you to have a weekend with me and my wife in Westchester. And I flew to New York, and I spent a weekend with my dad, and I was going to meetings every day. And at the end of my trip, he said, I'd love to go to one of those OA meetings with you. And I took him to a meeting, and at the end of the meeting, he raised his hand, and he said, my name's Lou, and I'm an overeater, and I've been in denial my whole life. And people were hugging him after the meeting, and he was crying. Like, it was wild. And I was like, this is higher power. And, oh, my dad's one of us. I treat my fellows with so much compassion. when I hear them, when I hear their struggles. It's like, oh, my dad's a fellow now. Like, that's wild. I got to really, you know, you don't have to like everybody, but you love them in a very special way. And I started to have a relationship with my dad. And 5 years ago, I got married, and my dad gave the toast at my wedding. And if you told me that 5 years ago, or if you told me that whenever, I would have been like, you're nuts. Like, what are you talking about? And the best men at my wedding were program people. And I, you know, every part of my wedding felt like recovery. And, you know, my sponsor, when I was talking to him about canceling speaking, he said, you know, David, God, if you want to know what God is, just look at what's happening. Like, that's life. Like, God is life in disguise. And I went through a long period, the last 5 years, where life was, like, amazing. My work just kept getting better and better, and I started, like, manifesting things at a really high level, and my relationship was really good, and my wife and I bought a house, and my friendships were all great, and just, like, life was booming. And I was really in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I moved back east in March. And I'm really going to lean into Tradition 12 here, the anonymity aspect. But I moved back east in March. And it was amazing. Like, my wife and I bought this house on a lake. And it just felt so higher power guided. And then in May, she ended up in the hospital with all these issues that were, like, happening with her brain. And we couldn't figure out, and she kept going back to the emergency room. And then I went and did something for work for 2 months, and my work just kept getting bigger, and my wife just kept getting sicker. And in August, I don't know what happened other than what I would call some kind of breakdown, mental breakdown. And my whole life was destroyed in 4 weeks, and I lost everything, the house, my wife, the dogs. And since then, she has, like, gone even more off the deep end. Not like I've turned into this enemy, and we had the most beautiful marriage. We traveled the world. Like, it was just this beautiful 5 years, and now she's, like, allegations, and I'm having to sue her. And, you know, it's crazy. But without program, I'm in the food, and I am probably want to take my life. But because of program, because I used to make the calls when life was good, and I learned how to make the calls when life was bad, I'm surrounded by love, and I'm surrounded by recovery. And I moved back to LA, and I stayed for a month at a fellow's house, and I call my sponsor every day. And there's something beautiful in going through really the gnarliest period of my life and staying open and not closing my heart. All of my life, when things got bad, I would just shut down and get smaller and want to hide. But, like, how do I stay open through that? Like, how do I stay raw and still show up for my life? And the duality of life. Like, yeah, this is going horribly, but over here, actually, life's going amazing. And I have work things that are happening that are beyond my wildest dreams. And program allows me to hold both of it. And what time does for me is it gives me now, like a scientist, it gives me a 13-year period that I can look back on and I can say, I have been taken care of every single time. Like, not only is God everything or God is nothing, that phrase is what you tell somebody when you don't know what to say for me. Like, when somebody used to call me, like, with something horrible, I'm like, well, God's everything or God's nothing. But really, not only is God everything or God is nothing, but, like, the pain is the touchstone of the next phase of my life. And I know that without question. There's no part of me that's, like, yes, I've had to burn a quarter of my net worth on lawyers, like, not just divorce lawyers, defamation lawyers. Like, I'm having to walk through things that I didn't know how to walk through, but there's somebody in program who does, and that's why I have to share about it, because when I share about it, somebody always comes up and says, this happened to my sister, or this happened to me too, or call this person. And this program isn't just about getting restored to sanity with food. It's about life. It's a design for living. And this fellowship for me means more than anything, like now more than ever, to have people, like normal people don't know what to say. And normal people don't know how to hold a tremendous amount of pain, in my experience. But program people do. And I'm just so grateful. Like, I'm just so grateful that I didn't cancel today. I'm just so grateful that looking back, you know, somebody heard me when they were 17. Somebody young will probably hear me today. And then in 3 years, I'll be back here. And I'll probably be married. And I'll probably be like, rejection was protection. And I'll probably say, wow, that person did for me what I would have never done for myself. And to have that perspective today is such a gift, because I was such a victim when I got here. Like, I just thought that I manifested badness. Like, I just thought that here's another reason why life is against me. And for whatever reason today, I just believe that life is happening in my favor, and it's going to be good. And it already is good. It's all working out for me. So with that, that is my time. Thank you for having me.
Amazing.